Blog Talk Radio.
Take too many pills to heal. Rich Bergeron. And
hey.
There it is. All right. Well, we got an actual for everybody tonight. We have a phenomenal box.
Rich, can you hear me? We're getting a
real bad connection. Uh-oh. Hold on. Let me hang up on you and... All right. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you loud and clear. That sounds really good.
All right. So hopefully our guests will get a better reception now that we fixed that. Anyway, we have Roy Jones Jr. tonight, one of the probably...
legends.
Yeah, obviously he's a legend, but he's also, I think, one of the only boxers to fight in, I think, like six different weight classes. Started out as a
He didn't do it in 1 3-month span like I did.
No. I'm sure you're going to have to tell him that story.
I'll have to talk about that one.
He actually started out as an amateur at 119 pounds and then ended up in as a professional heavyweight and won titles.
He also got to bust his stones because I was really back in 300. I thought that was the biggest time he's saying, I had the first pick.
Wow. Little swaggy stuff to me. Tony?
Yeah.
He used to train in Philly, didn't he?
Who's that, Roy Jones?
Yeah.
If he did, it was not to my knowledge. We'll have to ask him.
Right. I know, Dan Philly. Anyway, he's multi-talented.
I'll ask one of them. Now, it's funny, because the guy that he is fighting next, Max Alexander, I know. I know Max from his, because obviously he can be from the, he fights out of Camden, but he fights a lot in the
Yeah.
Actually was the first fight that I ever covered for Fightings Unlimited when he fought on the Blue Horizon back in 07.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so
have to give
I'll definitely have to worry about that.
Okay, we also have Tom Yankello, who is Roy's trainer. He's going to come on for 15 minutes at 9 o'clock, and then after him we have finally John Phillips. I sent a reminder over to his PR agent today, but didn't receive a response back, so hopefully it goes through his commitment and everything. So scheduled, you ought to know about it. It ought to be cool going forward. So if not, I'm sure we can bullshit for a little while.
Well, I got a talent with that.
Today, I wanted to mention before we get Roy on in about 20 minutes here, supposedly, according to, United Kingdom website, The Telegraph newspaper there, Manny Pacquiao claims there's just a few little things to iron out before he signs to fight Floyd Mayweather. So.
I've been here for the last 2.5 years.
Right. But.
Now, from what I heard on some reports yesterday, once again, don't know how true these are or not, that it looks like Mayweather is set to fight on May 5th. And there's rumor for him. Of course, right now I'm drawing a blank. And the other rumor I heard was Pacquiao Marquez 4 on June 9th.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I actually wrote about. I wrote an article for crossing.com, and there's one that's holding up the Floyd Mayweather Pacquiao fight because he wants the Marquez rematch again.
And Dan Marquez.
And obviously,
he drinks his own urine.
And it's purely about money. It has nothing to do with, you know, whether fans really want that fight, I think. And reportedly, I guess Marquez is asking for $125 million. I heard one report that Mayweather refuses to fight for anything less than $100 million, which would be like,
what?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what I said. You know, obviously, he's doubling the amount that everybody thinks each fighter is going to get. The 100. I don't know if that's true, but yeah, that's pretty ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
And obviously, if Aram decides to put his fighter up against Marquez again, and that fight doesn't happen on May 5th between Mayweather and Pacquiao, there's still probably a little bit of a window to make. I do want to get it done. It's not going to be very likely. It's going to go, the odds are going to go way, way down.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't see it happening. Come on.
Yeah. I think it will. The only thing that held it up before was the blood test. Now that's kind of a done deal. They agreed to do it the way that Floyd wanted to do it. Danny obviously had such a weak performance that Floyd probably fell a little bit. Just watching it. And he's probably thinking it's going to be much easier now because he's either lost a step or, you know, he showed his weaknesses in any respect. So it's going to be definitely the best time for Floyd. And I think Floyd was really the player making it hard to get this fight signed. But now we're hearing it's actually Aram who's the one that's throwing the big roadblock in the situation. Because even before the Marquez fight, you had Pacquiao and all these talk shows saying he's ready, he's ready. Apparently, it's actually Aram and coach Pacquiao's conditioning coach, Alex and Lisa. Both want this fight now, next. And Aram is still committed to doing the Marquez fight. Which, I don't know, I mean, Marquez earned it, obviously. He earned another fight. But
yeah, absolutely.
But will it be better for the fans to watch? That's the thing. We'll see. Anyway.
I think the point that certain fighters are always getting entertaining. But he decided to
for years, I thought it would be Pacquiao, just by the basis of his performances that I watched. But we'll have to wait and see if it gets done, number one, and who wins. I don't know. It's tougher to call now, because obviously that's...
Well, when they first started talking about it a couple years ago, I really leaned a lot. I leaned to Mayweather. He was just a tremendously, fast and skilled boxer. You know, good movement, good defense, did everything, almost perfectly. And then he started getting away from, boxing. He was only fighting like once every 15 months or whatever it was. And then Pacquiao kept improving. And every time he looked more impressive and more impressive. So he was rocked by Mosley, and then he showed him, I'm trying to think of what was the fight he had before that. You know, he had the fight against the Marquez, he's smaller, and you know, he didn't knock him out, and he didn't go kill. And Pacquiao was my
Oscar De La Hoya, who was the one.
Oh, he demolished De La Hoya.
Grouping, but there is a bantamweight class in the UFC. I think it's like 130. 45.
Yeah, but I thought they were like 130 some pounds, 140 pounds.
Yeah. But it'll probably
bump up. Yeah.
Next year, and he's
a good Mantis.
Yeah, he's going to have to get some more before he's going to put this plan into motion. But interestingly enough, his promoter is up as Gary Shaw, who also managed him. And funny thing about Kimbo, too, one of his old opponents just turned connection down a fight. Bare knuckle boxing match with Bobby Gunn.
Oh, and really?
Bobby Gunn is fighting tonight, actually, outside of Philadelphia. Did you know that?
Oh, really?
Nope. He's fighting a guy who's 30-0, or so he claims, in bare knuckle boxing. And this is only the Gunn's second official bare knuckle boxing fight. And obviously,
he's
not publicizing where it's going to be. They're just saying it's somewhere outside. It's actually going to be broadcast on his website. Let me see if I can find it in my email. But anyway, Bobby, he's fighting this guy, Ernest Jackson. He says he's 30-0.
Ernest Jackson, I don't know the name, so...
broadcast it afterward. I don't know if they're going to charge for it or what. Didn't say. I think it's probably going to be free just to get the promotional aspect. He's trying to popularize that sport. I wrote a whole article about, kind of the history behind it. You can't sell tickets to it and publicize where it's going to be. Obviously, it's on the fringe of the regulated rules. But it changed the game a little bit. It's like a 100-round fight, like in the John L. Sullivan days.
Well, you know what's funny about those rounds? Eventually, with Sullivan's downfall, is when they turned him to 3 minutes. Because for a while, as soon as there would be a knockdown in a round, the round would be over. So a round could go 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. Or a round could go a fight, and walk out there and need a break, and just walk out there and take a knee. Funny thing about John L. Sullivan, I don't know if you ever heard this story, but he used to like to drink a lot. And they said in the one time they're fighting in like 100-degree weather, and they started off, they figured if he drank so much, he would do better than his whiskey. And he said, rolling up, it was 100-degree rolling up between rounds, and they're like, oh my God, and they told him, they're like, oh my God, we spiked your, water with whiskey there, you said, keep doing it, it's the water I'm rolling up, it's the whiskey, keep.
That's the story. I was doing a media search on his page there, and apparently he died with $10 in his pocket after all those fights. $10.
Yeah.
Which is probably not much even for his time.
I'm sure it's more then than it is now.
But he actually, there was a lot of controversy, a little bit, I guess, about Gunn claiming the world heavyweight title in bare knuckle boxing. But it seems just according to Wikipedia, the Bossberg even got a real title. It was just like an honorary title that was presented to him. So it was kind of like a gift thing. It wasn't, there was no sanction or decision title. It's kind of funny that Gunn associated himself with Sullivan by saying he's just claiming his belt. Because, that there's only one belt. It's a one and only belt because it's not. It's like a trophy a kid gets after feeding, It's his trophy. You can't just, run into his room and steal it and say, this is my trophy now. Like, his name is on it. So, I thought that was kind of funny. So that's it. It's IBKBA.com where you can watch the fight after it's over tonight. know, try to make it as mainstream like Bobby Gunn is. And hopefully he's going to fight this Irish guy that I talked about the last time we mentioned him. But IBKBA.com, that's where you go if you want to see him. If you want to check out Bare Knuckle Boxing. And we're going to have the real boxer on here in a couple minutes, Roy Jones Jr. He has a pretty decent record. 8 losses, 54 wins. Pretty good stuff. Forty knockouts to 54 wins too. That's a 64.5% knockout rate. And he's rated at Cruz now 4th in the United States, 17th in the world. Had a tough loss his last fight in Moscow. Had to go to Moscow to fight Lebedev.
And the guy that beat him beat James Toney pretty handily also.
Mm-hmm. As you said, he's fighting Max Alexander next. So he's going to fight that one in Atlanta, Georgia. Alexander's 14-5-2 with only 2 knockouts. So it seems
Alexander's a very slow-paced fighter, very methodical, not much of a puncher.
Roy, what is it all about?
I think so. I think this is a good fight for Roy. He's fighting a guy that is very, very slow-paced, very flat-footed. He's like a squirmy type guy. He's got long arms. It's very difficult to fight because he tries to really connate. He's not a guy that's going to put a lot of pressure on you.
Right.
I think this is a good fight for Roy. Maybe a confidence builder. And we'll see.
All right. Well, I hope you got your questions ready.
Oh, shit. Come on.
From Fight News Unlimited. We're also on the line, yeah. Tony the Tornado Pinnacal.
Yeah. Yo, what's up? What's happening? Not much. How are you?
Mike.
Tell us a little bit about this upcoming fight you got and what you know about Max Alexander.
I always know a whole lot about him. I really tried not to look at him in the contender series. But I thought I saw him finally tall. And I really tried not to really get him close to him because I need to get more to myself. So I kind of got him out and look at him and see what he does, what he's up to, whether they're trying for him or playing for him. My job, this time, is to distance myself to go in and see if they're playing.
Right. Well, actually, Tony knows a little bit about him.
Hey?
He's seen him fight.
We're just talking online. Working with Fight News Unlimited about 4 years ago, and the first fight card I covered, Max Alexander fought the main event down at the Blue Horizon in Philadelphia. And what I wrote about it that night was he's very tall. He's a very methodical type fighter. You know, he likes to keep a real slow pace, likes to keep the action in the center of the ring. He'll don't snap his jab. He probes with it sometimes. He likes to keep everything very methodical. He's not a big puncher. He's a very slippery type guy, but not a Pernell Whitaker type slippery. He's a guy that's gonna thwart an opponent's offense by just kind of using some footwork and just kind of keeping the guy from not throwing anything. He's the type of guy, I think, if there was 10 punches landed in the round, and he landed 7 of them, he'd be happy.
Right.
Right.
Actually, the best way to describe him would be, I would compare him a little bit like a guy that you might know a little bit about, a modern-day version of a Bernard Hopkins.
Exactly.
A guy that he fights in that type of style.
Right.
But not in that league.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, who's the toughest guy you say you ever fought, Roy?
I think the toughest guy I fought was James Tony.
Really? A prime James Tony. You were the first guy to beat him, too, right?
Yep.
Tell us about that.
After I was the second guy to beat him, the first guy I get credit for, but Dave Tiberio beat him, they didn't need me in the fight.
Oh,
right. I remember that.
Yep. Dave Tiberio beat him, but they cheated my fight. Dave Tiberio did beat him. Yeah, I beat him. But that fight was a great fight. It was because he was a modern throwback type fighter. You know, he fought that type of style and all the old kind of fault. They were having that shoulder, you know, turn the shoulders and count off the right hand, everything off the back leg. He had all the old school maneuvers down pat. So everybody thought he was the next best thing in boxing. But I knew that I had some new age stuff that was much quicker and much better than him. And with the old school style, he won't be able to beat me. But either. So it was my opportunity to have a coming out party. And the total event, my style was really good.
Awesome. And about your style, you were like really the first fighter to get away with race, moving around a lot, moving ahead. Obviously, fighters had done that before, but you were the first one to really make it famous and really perfect.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Right. Well,
to see that start to increase. The next generation, kids out there. I mean, I see it. I go to fights. I see kids, at least keeping one hand low, maybe not two like he used to do. But how did you develop that style? And tell us a little bit about,
I kind of looked at a lot of fighters coming up, and I kind of stole a lot from a lot of different fighters. Muhammad Ali being my favorite, because that's why I started boxing after watching Muhammad Ali. But after watching Muhammad and Shirina and Wolf Benitez and Marvin Hagler, Salvador Sanchez. After watching all the best, Victoria Pedro, I kind of got my style and kind of get behind my jab. I fought off my back leg too, but my favorite punch became my hook. So that's why I was different at.
Right.
Cool. Well, the one topic I wanted to talk to you about, and it was funny, I was mentioning it to Rich, when he told me we got you on the show tonight. A few months ago, we interviewed a teammate of yours from the 1988 Olympics, Ray Mercer. And
right.
The one thing he said to Ray was, what was it like being on the last real Olympic team? And that's no disrespect to the 92, 96,
right.
Beyond that. But it was your fight that, unfortunately, for the, I think, the negative, changed the way Olympic boxing is now and the reason it's not mainstream anymore, and tell us what that experience was like over in Seoul, Korea.
Well, it was one of the best experiences in my life, but what I'm going to tell you is something that people don't care for the real truth, though, and here's what the problem is. The reason they lost interest in boxing is because they caught a robbery on tape, and they didn't go back and rectify it. How dumb can you be? If you go back and clear yourself, now the public realized that, okay, they made a mistake, they took care of the guys, they punished the guys that did it, but they go back and correct it. Now, if they correct it, they claim the guy to go wrong, but they still didn't go back and take the money from the criminal and give it back to the right owner. If you not want to take stealing, why won't you go back and get the money from the criminal and give it back to the right owner? So you saw him steal her watch, you will catch him put in jail, know you got her watch at home, but you're not going to get her watch and give it back to her? And that's what took it away. That was dumb. How can you go and crucify people for doing wrong or punish them for doing wrong, but don't go correct the wrongs they did? We're human beings. How much sense does that make? And that's what happened. So they're like, y'all don't leave it like that. So boxing, it really is cool that much. They're just letting them go in and get robbed, kid. And they don't even care about the situation.
Yeah, I mean.
They're not going to tell people.
Even after the fact, it could be 10 years down the road, but they need to wake up.
Huh?
Even if it's 10 years down the road and they corrected it, it should have been corrected.
Yeah, I mean, come on, dude. You got to think of it. You got a robbery right there, too. Why won't you go rectify the situation? Don't leave it like that. Now people think you don't care. So then turn another game drops. How they think, you know what? get you kicked boxing. They don't give a care about it. They don't want to go back and kick it. Look, everybody in the world where the war got robbed. Did they do anything about it? No, they didn't give it another thing. What the heck?
And as I was, yeah, I was even saying to Merciless Ray when we were talking to him, and we were talking about how that very decision and how the Korean officials had wined and dined some of the judges and basically, you know, buttered them up to who they wanted to win that fight. That's why they changed the current system they have with the judges and the punch pad, which I think is ridiculous. And I remember because I really started getting back into boxing. I used to watch it with my dad when I was young, back in the late 70s, early 80s. The guys like Matthew Saad Muhammad out of Philadelphia, Chandler, Sugar Ray Leonard, all those guys. And then I started getting back into it in the mid-80s with Mike Tyson. And, of course, another former opponent of yours, Vinny Pazienza. Those are the guys that really started getting me back into it. So I started getting my first boxing magazines around the 88 time frame. And what I used to like what Ring Magazine would do was they would profile the U.S. team. And they would say, okay, this weight class, we got Roy Jones, Jr. And, you know, here are some of his amateur credentials. And here's some of the major obstacles he's going to have in the Olympics to win the gold medal, and here are his chances. So you got to really have a feeling, and you got to almost know these guys when they were still amateurs, and then, you know, you have your, you know, your career, like guys like you, Riddick Bowe, Ray Mercer, all the great fighters from 88. So when you guys all turned pro, you know, we're, as fans, even me as a 12-year-old kid, we're excited to start following your career because we followed you in the amateurs. They don't do that anymore.
No, but you also had a way to follow our career. Of course, you had NBC, USA Boxing. You had all types of different outlets that still show boxing. Now you don't have that no more. So it's very difficult for you to see it because you don't have it no more. So now, even if you want to follow it hard, just think about it. The kid that won, I'm looking at the last one, if you want to follow it, was a kid, Deontay Wilder. He was a heavyweight that did win a medal. I mean, he got a problem, but if he got a medal, he was all going to win a medal. But if you don't go around and watch boxing or do like I do with commentate, then it's like, there's no way you will ever follow his progress because you're not going to see him every night, man.
Right.
Now, Roy, how did you first get into boxing as a kid?
I can't hear you.
How did you first get into boxing?
Oh, I watched Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, the late great Joe Frazier, and I saw Muhammad Ali was doing to him, and I really enjoyed it, and it made me want to box. If somebody could teach me how to throw my hands, I could do exactly what Muhammad Ali is doing.
And what was your very first fight like?
It was late day weekend back in 1979.
Did you beat the guy in your first amateur fight?
Yep, I beat him.
All right. And what would you say is your ultimate goal in the sport?
I can't hear you.
What would you say is your ultimate goal in the sport?
You know what?
Ultimate goal in the sport.
Oh, my ultimate goal was winning every title and come back and win and recap the last every title if I did it. Now my last goal is to win a cruiserweight title.
Speaking of when we were, when you fought the heavyweight, that was back in 2003 against John Ruiz. Once again, I was joking with Rich before we got you on the air. I was like, I was so mad about that fight. I had a coworker, and we would bet on all the big fights, and we would each take turns because he wouldn't let me take the first choice, obviously, because I know the sport of boxing. So you know, I had been beaten so many bets. He goes, "This one, you got to let me have first pick." And I'm like, okay. He's like, well, I'm going to take Roy Jones. I'm like, of course you're going to take Roy Jones. So I'm like, all right, I'll go with you. I'll make a bet with you. So, of course, I didn't order the fight. I don't know if I was following it that night or I forget what was going on. But somebody had sent me a message like, you know, Jones won the decision. I'm like, God damn it, I got to buy this guy a sandwich. I got to buy him lunch. And what happened, so I am a native Philadelphian guy. I grew up, born and bred in Philadelphia. I trained in Philadelphia while I was fighting for a lot of years. And this guy had me order him a cheesesteak and put mayonnaise on it. I was like,
wow.
That is an insult to my Philadelphianism.
It's too funny. Too funny.
Now, really, haven't you spent some time training in Philadelphia?
No, I spent time in Pennsylvania, not Philadelphia.
Oh, Pennsylvania. Then. So
yeah.
Out of the Philadelphia area, upstate somewhere?
Yeah, up in California, Pennsylvania, and up in Anchorage.
That's where Tony's from, obviously. Philadelphia, if you can tell by his accent.
A lot of fighters in Philadelphia, not surprising in Philadelphia, but that's where my main competitors were, so I didn't want to go to where they were to train, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, and of course, you know, as you just mentioned a few moments ago, talking about Ali and Frazier, and obviously Philadelphia is, you know, kind of still in mourning over the loss of Joe Frazier. I didn't get a chance to meet him if I wanted to. But yeah, I got to see Joe on a number of occasions, and just, you know, watching some of the clips of him grow. As you said, you kind of developed a lot of your style from watching Ali. I learned a lot from watching Joe Frazier, because I bought a video when I was 13, and they had Frazier's on, and they kept talking about the Philadelphia left hook. I said, what? I'm going to start throwing a left hook. I'm from Philadelphia. And
I heard that. Don't get me wrong. I stole that, too.
Excuse me?
I stole that from you, too. Don't get me wrong. I stole that from Joe, too. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, I know. Believe me. I've watched it.
Yeah, I had Joe Frazier left hook, too. Don't get me wrong.
And that's one thing when you're talking about, like, back in the day, when you're first breaking into your pro career, it was great for a boxing fan, especially for me growing up, because you had so many outlets, not just reading the magazine, but for casual fans, you knew where to find good fights. They weren't doing as much on the afternoons anymore, the networks, but you still had every Tuesday night, you knew like clockwork, Tuesday
night
fights would be there for you. One of my biggest complaints, I'm happy that ESPN2 runs a show, and I like the studio broadcast they do, where they have different fighters in there, and, you know, that's good for a fight fan, because they're not just getting two announcers. They're getting somebody that has, you know, obviously, high credentials in there.
Right.
But my biggest complaint is they go on hiatus from September to January. So when they restart back in January, it almost takes you a few weeks to get, you know, back in the frame that, hey, it's Friday night, there's going to be fights on. And they sometimes it's 8 o'clock at night, sometimes it's 9, sometimes it's 10. And then on weekends I have to work, when they start a broadcast as late as 11, 12 o'clock at night, well, I think I got to work, you know, the next day at 6 a.m. You know, I don't want to be getting up late. You know, I'm tired. And you don't get a chance to really have it in that mindset of, you know, I know it's Friday night, I'm going to be watching fights.
Yeah.
That's a thing away from the game.
Because nobody knows it. There's no way to find out. There's no way to follow. I mean, if this covers up, Jesse Wilder had an excellent knockout win. That's what happened because the fight was ended so quick on HBO. The HBO fight didn't even show it. But if not for that, you might have never got to see that. You feel me?
Exactly. And just by luck, over the summer on ESPN, I had a very good friend of mine fighting out in Chicago, a kid from Philadelphia by the name of Hank Lundy. He's a lightweight. And he fought. It was a bloody fight. You know, he knocked out, I believe the guy's name was David Diaz, knocked him out in the sixth round after betting off the canvas himself. And just by chance, a young kid that I'm training happened to know that there were fights on that night. And he heard me mention when we were working out a day or so before that a friend of mine's fighting on ESPN. So he just happened to tune in. And then he got Facebook on Twitter and said, who was your friend that fought tonight? I said, did you see that great knockout? He's like, yeah. I'm like, that was him. And I took this kid to right now he's just training with me. He's thinking about breaking into the amateurs maybe in a few months to a year. And I took him his first fight card in Philadelphia about 2 months ago. just to meet some of the guys, you know. Max Alexander was there. Fast Eddie Chambers was there, you know, shaking hands with people and talking to people. And I told this kid, Jeff, I said, Jeff, I said, remember that great knockout you saw 3 months ago? He said, yeah. I said, well, there goes the guy right there. And this 17-year-old kid's jaw hit the ground.
Right.
And it kind of reminded me when I was first starting out, you know, when I was 17 years old and going to fight cards. And there were guys, you know, like I went to a fight card when I was 15, and there was Riddick Bowe standing 10 feet from me.
Yeah.
All 6'5" of them. Huge.
Yeah.
And even now that I'm, you know, in my 30s and I'm training guys now, and I get starstruck all the time when I'm at the fight, and it's a good feeling.
It's a wonderful feeling.
Where do you get starstruck?
Yeah, I think it's also not really starstruck, but I still admire guys, you know what I'm saying? I admire people for their work, and I love seeing guys in their parts, you know. It's just a great thing to see it and see what God can do with people sometimes and want to pay. So I still love to see guys. I love to meet guys, especially the older guys, the guys that came before my time. I love to pay them their respect, and I wouldn't call it starstruck, but I do love paying people their respect. You know, just some of those guys, they deserve respect. You know, if I saw their home, I'm going to see if I'm their home, deserve respect. If you get more respect than they gave, because to me, he's on the greatest of their chances up.
That's cool. Absolutely. On a different topic a little bit, have you enjoyed doing the work on HBO?
I love it. I get to speak with my final staff for instead of a fan staff or a person who just read about boxing but never been in that before.
You remember a guy named Reggie Johnson, right?
Yep.
I actually wrote an article about Reggie years ago, and it's one of the best stories I ever got of a fighter. He said that his father was more proud of his fight against you than any other fight.
His father what?
Fight. His father was more proud of Reggie's fight against you than any other fighter. Reggie's.
Why?
He said because he got up so many times. He knocked him down five times in that fight, he said.
Mm.
And he still kept getting up and getting up. And his father was more proud of that than anything else that he ever saw his kid.
That's all right. That's all right.
What was that like fighting him?
It was fun, because back in 91, he was looking at my father's phone. And my father tried to get his phone, so I saw him for one round, and I got out. My father got mad. He said, get back up there. I said, I'm not getting back up there. So why not? Because I can beat him. I'm not getting back up there. I'm not going to teach him how to beat me. And the kid was like, I'm not getting back to this, so I didn't get back up there. And I knew he would fight one day. And so did Reggie. So, lo and behold, in 96, here we go.
Yeah, I just got a letter from Reggie, too. He's, unfortunately, Reggie's actually in prison right now.
I heard that, man. I heard that.
Yeah, he actually writes me letters all the time.
Hey, let me talk to him again. Are you still going to let me ask about him, okay?
All right, yeah, sure.
How are you doing? You okay?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to read a little, his last line in this latest letter. He says, will this mishap in my life kill Reggie Johnson?
Did you hear that?
This is his last line in the letter he just sent me. He says, will this mishap in my life kill Reggie Johnson? Did instant coffee kill coffee? The best is yet to come. So he's still
he's
got a good mindset in there, you know.
That's good.
I think he'll be able to get out of parole soon.
Huh?
I think he'll be able to get out on parole pretty soon, in a few months.
Okay, good.
He's got credit for time served, and they had him in jail for a while before they even actually. They had him in jail for a while before they actually, you know, convicted him.
Prison. Right.
So he'll probably get out pretty soon.
Okay.
Anyway, on a lighter note, what was your best moment so far in the sport? You had to pick one.
In the sport? My best moment was when I did a chicken move with Jack Tony, caught him with that hook and knocked him down. When I hit Ben Jones with the hook right hand, both of them on the same side of his face, left hand and right hand, and on the same left side of his face. That was amazing. And he really got so fast that he can't get his face back to the middle.
in time for the right hand, hit him about that. And I think I'm going to hit Joe Reese, and it may have been the first, second round. I don't want to go out bust his nose. It was probably my favorite thing moment. Then when I hit the boy, hit him with the right hand from right on my back, that was pretty impressive. In the back, trying to get a first here, that was pretty impressive. In the last combination that I set up in the parallel with, that was pretty impressive. Overhand, right here, Arthur Woman with, that was pretty impressive. Hook I caught Jorge Baca with, that was pretty impressive. That was a pretty impressive move. I think it's a whole lot of them.
Yeah, it must be hard to isolate so many good moments, pick one, but you're like the only guy who's ever done that and been justified to pick like nine. You've been through so many different weight classes, too. What was that like, going from 190 as an amateur all the way up to heavyweight?
Well, I guess I was God showing up to give me a freedom to what I was going to do, you know? I mean, I started at 119, and then I'll come back on 139, then I'll come back on 156. I guess I was swimming in. You ain't never going to be in one place, so you're going to get rid of it. I just didn't know.
And what if you had to pick something, what would you say is the best thing about being a boxer? What do you love most about it?
And what's the best thing about being a boxer?
Yeah, what do you love most about just being a boxer?
I think that's you learn life lessons straight on firsthand. You learn to get knocked down, you got to get up. You learn when things get rough, the rough get going. You know, all the old things about life, you're going to let them all to box. And that's the best thing about boxing. Boxing is a real sport, it is.
Yeah,
closest thing related to life on earth.
That's probably one of the best answers we got to that question. Tony, used to box ourselves back in college.
That was what we were talking about before we got you online. One of the things I always joke about, because we were talking about how you fought so many different weight classes, even in your pro career, started off at 154, then up to heavyweight. I was standing around. I was like, back in '97 when I was a junior, I became the only guy in college boxing to successfully fight in five weight classes in a 3-month span. I started off at around 185 that year because I was normally around 172 to 175, but I had had a pretty major knee surgery, so my running and conditioning was lagging behind, and the season was starting. So I took a fight at 190, and I felt all right. The next week I was down to about 182. I'm like, okay, I'll drop down, the extra 2 pounds and fight at 180. They're like, we need you to fight at heavyweight. I said, excuse me? They're like, we need you to fight at heavyweight. I'm like, coach, I'm 5'8", and I'm barely 180. They're like, we need this one from you. They're like, just like Marciano used to do, don't worry about it. You're Italian. I said, okay.
Right.
So I fought a guy. Yeah, exactly. Still a very good friend of mine. So we fought. He was 6'3", 210. And then the next week I fought at heavyweight again. I was actually weighing in with rocks in my pockets. And then I fought heavyweight again against a guy that became a 2-time national champion and a future Navy SEAL. Lost that fight and cut. So then I fought the next week after patching up the cut myself. It was in my lip. I wouldn't get stitches. So I fought the next week. Now I'm at 180 and I'm happy. We get to the regionals a few weeks later. Actually, the regionals was the night after you got disqualified in that fight against Montel Griffin. Because we were watching it. We had me and my one buddy were watching it. We're both from Philadelphia. We're in the dorm room. And he had to make weight by bumping up in weight. So he's eating a huge chicken parmesan sandwich. And I'm eating an orange sliver because I decided to drop 15 pounds in about 2 days. Got to 165 for the regionals, and I was winning the fight, but I had nothing left. And the guy hit me with a shot that normally I would laugh at. My knees buckled. I went down. I got up, and that cost me the decision. So from that on, I completed and went to 172. So when I saw my old college coach last year for our reunion, and I asked him, I said, you run the National Collegiate Boxing Association now. You're the president. Has anybody else ever done that? And he looked at me and he goes, I don't think anybody else was ever stupid enough to do that.
Yeah, my worst weight was when I wrestled in high school. And I ex-
had to wrestle at 171 for most of the senior year, even though I was weighing about 156 to 160 most days. And the captain was wrestling at 160, so I couldn't take his spot. So they put me up at 171. And then there was a match where they said they might have to bump me up to 189. So I said, shit, you know, there's no way I can make the minimum weight. So they made me drink 2 gallons of water to go against a guy who was a three-time state champ at 189. 20 pounds off. And it was like the match that the whole meat depended on, too. It sucked because they throw me out there and they just stay off your back, you know. The kid wrapped me up in a pretzel and I was done.
I'm afraid to meet it.
So it was kind of fun not to have to cut weight, but to have to gain weight, man, that sucked.
Yeah, yeah, that's tough too. But cutting is much tougher than gaining.
Roy, did you have a lot of trouble getting back down to light heavyweight after you moved up to heavyweight?
Yeah, I did. A whole lot of the thing I've had to do.
Yeah. I know a lot of times if guys put on weight, and you see like actors that do it for like movie roles and stuff. I remember the guy that was in Metal Jacket gained like 70 pounds just to you know, play the overweight recruit. That was mostly, you know, fat. When you bulked up to play Ruiz, remember you went on a program. Did you get Mackie Schultz done for that?
Yeah, I sure did. I gained muscle. I felt so hard to lose.
Yeah, as I said, you built up all the muscle, and that's what's hard, you know, to cut back down because your body gets used to that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to, when you said a few minutes ago what you love most about boxing, and, you know, it's a one-on-one thing, when you get knocked down, what you got to do is get back up.
Exactly.
I do a debate with Rich and any other guest that we have on the show, because we do a lot of boxing versus mixed martial arts, the debate, and I'm a boxing guy. I always have been, and I always will be. And I always say the one thing I really like about boxing was the fact that in a lot, and I'm not saying all of them, but in a lot of mixed martial art fights, you might have a fighter that gets knocked down, you know, gets caught with a shot, gets knocked down, and a lot of times that fight will be over. The guy will pounce on him while he's stunned, hit him 3 or 4 times, and will stop the fight. I said, what I love about boxing, I said, you know, say, Roy Jones is, you know, he's fighting Max Alexander in a few weeks, and Roy catches Max with a, you know, a leaping left hook. Max goes down, and, you know, you can see he's stunned, but he gets up, and it's like, you know, he breaks his cobwebs off and survives that round. Perfect example was about a month ago, that fight between James Kirkland and Alfredo Angulo on HBO. I said, if that was an MMA fight, it would have been over since Kirkland's cancer.
You're exactly right. You are exactly right.
All right, well, we got to bring your trainer on. We have him scheduled for 9 o'clock. Do you want to stay
up? Thank you, guys. Y'all, I enjoyed it. I got to sit down here with him for a wonderful talk to you guys. And I hope y'all get to talk to him. And I hope y'all get it some good coverage, yeah? And I look forward to hearing from y'all as our people before next week, all right?
Hell yeah. Well, is there anybody you want to give a shout-out to or say hello to before you go?
I just want to give a shout-out to all my fans, everybody that supported me throughout the year. And I thank y'all so much. All those who are concerned about my health, I thank you all very much for saying that I'm okay. If I thought I was going to be hurt or something was wrong with me, I would be the first to stop. So I love you, just like y'all love me. So thank y'all for supporting me. Keep God praying this day and God bless all y'all.
Keep up the good work. Thanks a lot.
Well, Roy, good luck when you fight Max Alexander. Wish you the best of luck in everything you do. I'm going to try to get down to some more HBO cards in Atlantic City, and you know, now that I'm starting to get some of the press passes and everything, I'm going to be able to, you know, down there, and I'll be sure to say hi.
Too late, Tony. You hung up 10 minutes ago.
Well, I'll still say hi to him.
Yeah, that part. Sorry, I should cut you off. The trainer is going to tell us all about his conditioning. Well, that was a great interview, Roy. Got a lot in there. A little time.
training. I'm going to get the option to stay on with Tom, but...
You've reached world-class boxing. Is your name and number? World class boxing. Is your name and number?
Thank you.
All right, we're back. We had a little unplanned break there. Apparently, Tommy Ankello is too busy with his fighters, so we'll try to get him on independently another time. Try him again after the John Phillips interview, since he's only scheduled for about 15 minutes officially. But our goal is to keep him on for 3 hours, Tony. No. But John Phillips is coming on. He's an attorney. He's an expert in head injuries. And fortunately, I was kind of under the gun today, so I didn't write too much on the blog and the description of the show about him this time. But I know on the last time he was supposed to appear, I had all of his credentials and stuff in front of me. But I do have, what they sent over. And he's been on the Today Show. He's pretty much nationally known as an attorney. He's rated by Martindale, licensed to practice in 3 states. He's a 2-time Florida super lawyer. And he appeared, on the Today Show and many other media outlets. He's also a certified contract advisor, and he hosts his own legal and sports radio show. So he's going to try to one-up us with his hosting capabilities, I think. And in addition, he's also a legal historian. So he likes the history of the law as well as the practice. But the topic that we're going to discuss today, he actually went on the Today Show to talk about. And basically, he's dealing with the head injuries across all sports, because sports in general, even sports with helmets, sometimes even more so sports with helmets, and headgear and all that stuff, boxing, but head injuries. Basically, he's going to perspective on that. Well, in about 8 minutes, we're scheduled to get him on here. So while we're waiting, I did want to mention that big events coming up this weekend. The finale of the Ultimate Fighter reality show on UFC. It's actually going to be on Spike, the broadcast, but you're going to have Jason Mayhem Miller versus Michael Bisping. Fight, because you get these two coaches. They've been really hamming it up on the show, with all the hype and doing pranks on each other, pushing each other around a little bit, talking smack, and it's almost like 24/7 on steroids the way they do the show. You get every perspective on these guys, and it's been pretty interesting season. Actually, Dana White went ahead and said that these were the best fights he's ever seen on this show. Whether that's just a promoter and him talking or he's really serious, but if he is really serious, that's saying a lot. And there are some good guys on this show. Diego is in the final. I can't think of his last name off the top of my head, but everybody knows my last name by now. Diego on the show is the other Diego. And this kid is like a little Jose Aldo. Waiting to happen. And he's just mowed down guys. And he fought this guy, Johnny Bedford, on the finale last night. And this Bedford guy was like tall and lanky. He had really good jiu-jitsu skills. Really, he was really good on his feet. And, you know, his plan going into the fight was to take this kid down. And there's no way he could take him down. That was the other fight. Diego fought a guy named Caraway, Ryan Caraway. And talk about, you know, the standing eight count in boxing. This kid needed a standing eight count. The other fight I was talking about, Johnny Bedford fought John Dodson, and he was trying to take him down. And basically, Dodson was so short and stocky, he wouldn't let him take him down, and then he ended up hitting right on the button with a left hook, knocked him down on his back, and just pounded on his face. And basically, the kid was out of his world. They woke him up, and they asked him if he knew where he was, and he said, Ohio.
Yeah.
The show's in Vegas, so he didn't know where he was. But he was really bummed out about the loss, and Dodson goes forward there. But the other fight was Diego versus Ryan Caraway. And Caraway, I mean, you got to give the kid credit for his heart. One of the things about the show that highlighted part of his character, they made a lot of mention of how nervous he was before fights. He said he shook before like 90% of his fights because he got so nervous. But he's good. You know, he's a real world-class grappler. And, you know, just went into that fight against this Diego kid, a little shaky on his feet, you know, a little bit nervous. After the first bell, and just never got a rhythm. And Diego just kept punching and kicking and kneeing him. And this kid was literally like wandering around the cage like a freaking zombie, you know. And he wanted to side with the ref who wasn't stopping it, but at some point it was like, ooh, man, you know, call it quits. This kid's not going to recover. And finally he ended up squaring his back and took one final huge right hook from the top, and then it was over. It was a good fight. You know, he tried, he hung in there for, I think it went into the second round. I just watched it once today real quick. But it's good stuff, you know. It was a great last episode. It's going to be a great card. I'm sure they're going to throw a bunch of other fighters on there from the show. I haven't actually gone and looked at the official fight card, because they don't develop that until, you know, today. It's not in the books until the final show is over. And we've actually, you know, we've interviewed Chuck O'Neill, who's on one of the more recent episodes, or seasons, I should say. And, you know, he gives us a little bit of perspective about how that whole situation is. You know, a lot of people think, you know, these guys just fought last week on the show. They're fighting in the Octagon. No, they do this months in advance. These guys sign confidentiality agreements for like $5 million in damages if they spill the beans. And it's basically 6 weeks, I think, is what Chuck O'Neill said. And, you know, you're going fight after fight, and they're exhibitions. So that's how they get away with it, you know, fighting so soon after one after the other. And, you know, it's like a real... It's like probably the more close or closer to the old school way the UFC used to do things than ever, you know. And it's a little bit barbaric when you think about it. But, you know, that's their proving grounds. That's their basic training. And most people end up in the big leagues there because they went through that. And a lot of those guys hang around. It used to be just one would get a contract at the end of the show. Now this season they're doing two weight classes, two contracts officially. And there's going to be three or four different guys in this class that end up being UFC fighters for a little while until they lose, you know, two or three in a row, or they don't climb the ladder. They just stay still and can only beat a certain class of guys. But we'll see. You know, it's going to be a good card, whoever they put out there. It's free, so that's a good thing. Not Spike. Yeah, it's just, you know, anything that's associated with the Ultimate Fighter, it's always... They always throw it on Spike, but this is going to be the last of the last for them. They're going over to Fox next year for the Ultimate Fighter, and it's going to be a little bit more dynamic. They're going to have fans voting in, calling and voting in, like the stupid singing show, Dancing with the Star. There's like nine stupid singing shows now. American Idol. So, I'm probably going to hate me on that, Tony. What? All right. Well, so, yeah, it's going to be a big show on Spike this weekend and tomorrow night, actually. So tune in, watch it. And this is actually, interestingly enough, too, the first time the coaches are fighting on the finale card. So Miller and Bisping are going to go at it. Yeah, it's going to be a hell of a fight, I think. I'm actually thinking Bisping, but I want Miller because I just don't like Bisping. He's not a class act. He's threw an illegal knee in his last opponent and then he spit on his coaches. So not the kind of role model the UFC should be trumpeting right now. But anyway, we'll see if the Brit gets sent home with an ass kicking. Now we're going to get John on the phone. John Phillips, our head injury expert.
John?
Hey, John, how's it going? This is
good, how are you?
This is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited.
Excellent.
And we're also on the line with Tony the Tornado Pennicow.
Hey, what's up? What's up, Tony? Not too much, how are you? Good, good, good. Looking forward to this.
Now, tell us a little bit about your expertise in the head injury area. Obviously, we cover combat sports, mixed martial arts, and boxing on this show, but you know, you also have to deal with it in football and the other sports, and we talk about that every now and then on the show, too. So just give us the rundown of, you know, what your expertise there is.
Well, I'm a 10-year personal injury attorney, and I've handled literally, probably about 100 of these cases. It's, that's a very specialized area. And dealing with, not only as a personal injury attorney, but as an NFL agent, you're dealing with, concussions and then secondary impact syndromes where you get two concussions within a short period of time, and it's what Ashika Lay had, situation that affected her. And then, you go into CTE and ALS with brain injury and, at its highest levels. But, I've deposed probably the best of the best with some of the medical professionals, and, by no means am I a doctor, but, we have to know what's affecting our clients to be able to serve them.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the worst cases we've discussed on this show was Chris Benoit in the combat sports, which we sometimes include wrestling in those. But we talked about him time and time again, and he actually created a lot of controversy because of what they found in his head after he died. They said he had the brain of like an 80-something-year-old man.
Right.
When they found him after he killed his wife and son. It's a horrible story.
It's unfortunately it's fairly typical, because what you've got, and that's part of the CTE stuff, is you've got these guys that are in any sport with physical contact, getting these lesions day in, day out, and it's Dave Duerson with the Bears killed himself.
Andre Waters with Philadelphia Eagles.
Right.
I grew up watching Andre Waters.
Yeah, Waters, and then the kid with the Bengals that jumped out of the car, and they said he was riddled with.
That was Chris Henry.
Chris Henry. When they when they examined his brain, he had the same issue with all these little black lesions that's classic CTE, which tracks like ALS, and it's just bad, bad stuff.
Now, what kind of cases have you been involved in where you were able to get some kind of relief for the people that sued over these injuries?
Anything from an automobile accident to the cases, like Ashika Lay is, the boxer that was injured in the Olympic qualifying last month, where she was sparring with a man 10 days prior to a qualifier and suffered headaches, obviously had a walking concussion, and her medical team, instead of treating the symptoms, gave her narcotic pain medication to mask the symptoms. She went on to fight, because that's what a competitor does, a competitor can be. She fully disclosed that she was having headaches for 10 days, went into the ring, was winning the fight, but took a shot to the head, and, you know, her eyes started to dot around according to her competitor, and a few minutes later, without contact, she was on the mat, got cold, and was in concussion for a month, and the heel just now started to come out of it. So, we did get into the liability in a rear-end auto collision. It's obviously, you know, side swipe, if somebody hits their head on the window, it's a little more obvious the liability, where liability is. But with the secondary impact syndrome, you see coaches, you see, you know, medical professionals, you know, that all the way on up into the medical malpractice category that we, you know, we've handled.
Right. And what would you say you enjoy most about being an attorney?
It's helping people. I mean, it's, you know, I get to be the mouthpiece of victims. And I don't say, you know, general slip and fall cases where somebody wants to do, you know, the city because there's a crack in the sidewalk. I take the higher end cases. And you know, the other case, I've gotten some media over with a young lady that was literally run over while she lay on base on a beach by a lifeguard that did a U-turn. On public areas, and it's, you know, being able to advocate for the issue delays and the hearing joints, and, you know, people truly dramatically injured by no fault of their own is the best part.
Well, I actually have a little bit of attorney experience myself. I've had to represent myself because I write a lot of investigative reports that people don't like, and I got sued for $25 million in 2007. The case is now in bankruptcy court.
Oh, wow.
And I've been representing myself ever since. I actually just got a $5,000 settlement a few weeks ago.
Where is that?
It's in Nevada, in Las Vegas. You know, the Fertittas who own the UFC?
Oh, wow. Okay.
They're actually owners of a company called Zions, which sponsors the UFC. And I wrote this big report about, you know, what was going on at the company, and I predicted the bankruptcy, and they decided they were going to sue me. So I started thinking, $25 million. My kids will be paying for that if I lose this case.
Right.
I just overnight tried to be my own lawyer, and it was rough going at first, but it's been an adventure, and it's starting to pay off. I'm starting to turn the corner.
It's a nonstop challenge. There's so many landmines out there. It's proud of your effort.
Yeah. The toughest part is, you know, it's the First Amendment, you know, and it's supposed to be black and white with a lot of these issues. You have to deal with these judges who, they don't want anybody publicizing anything bad about them, so they're going to shut you down. You know, so I've had a little bit of a tough road with that, but I'm picking things up, and I've actually appealed 4 times to the Seventh Circuit in one case involving a lady who was damaged by plastic surgery. And she had a blog all about it and what this doctor did to her. And I was supposed to be writing a book about her at the time. And the doctor sued her for defamation, had all her stuff removed, and the judge on the case was on the board of directors for the same company he paid his rent to, her facility, and his medical insurance to. So it was like she wouldn't step down either. She wouldn't accuse herself,
yeah,
no matter what.
That's a problem.
But getting back to the topic, as far as head injuries go, have you looked at all at the differences between MMA and boxing and the head injuries that occur in those two different sports there?
I have, and I haven't broken down the stats. I'd imagine they track fairly consistently just on the nature. Of, you know, if not MMA being, you know, worse because the nature of an elbow or, you know, something harder than a, you know, gloved hand, you know, impacting the ball. You know, a knee can do a lot more damage than this. You know, a gloved fist, most, you know, many circumstances. But I haven't practiced it.
Well, there was one study I talked about a few times on the show they showed that actually there was more per capita concussions in MMA than there were in boxing. But it's kind of like a toss-up, because in one sport you got the fighters constantly going for the head, so it's almost like in boxing you see a lot more people with Parkinson's and stuff, long-term effects, whereas in MMA, you know, these guys get really badly beaten up. They suffer, I think, more broken bones. Obviously, you know, it's rare that a guy breaks a bone in boxing unless it's his orbital or his, you know, his hand. But these guys, every joint could be subject to breaking in MMA. And the head injuries, the only thing I've ever heard is they have more concussions. But, you know, they insist it's safe.
Yeah, I would say that's consistent with everything that I know about it and have heard. And the difference is in amateur boxing and Olympic boxing, there's a lot more head gear in the earlier stages of training, whereas MMA is, you know, there's so much mixed martial art influence that where guys are taking a beating at a younger age as well.
Right. Yeah, the jury's still out, too, because boxing's been around for over 100 years. So, you know, it's a whole different story because we haven't seen enough time with MMA being even regulated in most states to decide whether it's more dangerous than boxing. But it's definitely a different type of danger.
Absolutely.
Now,
head injuries are no joke. It's, you know, like we were talking about with the CTE, you don't realize it that the poundings you're taking at, you know, 18, 16, 20, you know, those things don't oftentimes, when you're doing it repeatedly, they don't fully heal and they leave these little lesions and you know, that stuff adds up. And if you've ever studied Lou Gehrig's disease, man, that ends, you know, once from diagnosis to death is about 3 to 6 years. And CTE is actually basically tracks the same as ALS, and that's solely caused by repetitive head trauma. It's, you know, it's something we've all got to, you know, be a little bit more, you know, cautious over. And, you know, I realize you competitors want to compete, but, you know, you also want to be able to provide for your, you know, for your family and not, you know, with all respect to Muhammad Ali, be, you know, find yourself with Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig. It's a fine line.
Right. Yeah, a lot of these guys don't know when to retire, you know. These guys like James Toney comes to mind, you know. He's just not even in shape anymore. It doesn't look good in the ring, and he gets in there, and he's still taking a beat, you know. And some of them, actually, their speech goes first, it seems. You know, some of the older boxers, you can't recognize a word out of their mouth because they've gotten that slow, but it doesn't really affect their cognitive ability somehow in some cases. Like, I've known a few boxers that turned out to be trainers, and, you know, they seem to be like a half pace off, a little bit slow, but it's definitely not, you know, pronounced Parkinson's or anything like that, but you know, you can definitely tell that they were a fighter, you know.
And I'll tell you another thing that, you know, nobody ever really talks about. People always talk about, you know, because I fought a lot in the amateurs, and they're like, well, you wore headgear. I'm like, yeah. Headgear, for the most part, was mainly to protect your face, because with the cheek protectors, you know, the nose wasn't as pronounced with the, you know, the padding right over top of your eyebrow ridges kept, you know, for the most part, prevented cuts from over the eyebrows. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, you still got hit on the chin. I mean, you still could, you know, suffer a knockout, a knockdown. I've seen guys get knocked unconscious with headgear on. And the other thing they don't consider when it comes to boxing, okay, you have an amateur fighter. Let me go back to amateurs because that's with the headgear and everything. You have an amateur fight, you wear the headgear, you get stopped, whether it's a stoppage, you know, you got knocked down and the referee, you know, waved it off, but you were too, you know, stunned to continue. Or you got knocked down and you didn't beat the count, whatever, you're generally suspended for so many days. But you're training in the gym. You know, we were training in the gym in Lock Haven. There were times, you know, I got, you know, waylaid and I got, you know, cracked with a pretty good shot. There were times I got knocked on my ass in that Lock Haven gym. And, you know, I got up, but, I mean, there was still, you know, the cobwebs. And what was I doing the next day? No, I'm going back almost 20 years. So, I mean, obviously the studies and the research wasn't as good back then. The next day I got the headgear back on, and I'm sparring again. And you get sometimes injuries in training or even little, you know, cobwebs in training that nobody ever talks about. And that is, I think, a lot of a bigger issue.
Yeah. They don't mention it much in the NFL either. In the NFL, the first broadcast that I watched this year, they showed a new helmet that they had developed. But there's a big lawsuit in the NFL, John, that you're probably familiar with the against the helmet manufacturers in the NFL related to head injuries, right?
Absolutely. They, you know, they just haven't done enough. And until last year, they, you know, they had on ESPN a, you know, a Monday night segment called Jacked Up, like the worst hit. And you know, finally, some physicians got to them, and we realized that it's sensational, and it's, you know, fans like it, but this is not good. Concussions are not funny. Concussions are not cool. And it's made a difference in the class actions, and will be a lot more because it's taken, you know, essentially the lockout for some of these rights to be negotiated, and you know, trainers have to turn their heads being guys for $4 or $5 million a year and they want them to play. You know, there's a concussion in every NFL game every week of the season. If you don't hear about, you know, one player every week getting out a week, unless.
Right. And the hits that cause the concussions aren't always called as penalties either. You know, that's the thing they keep missing. That they're, you know, more aggressive on these penalties for launching and stuff like that, and helmet-to-helmet hits.
Right.
But, you know, those used to be the highlight reel hits, you know, for
concussions.
So, I mean, it's even hard for me as a fan knowing that, you know, it is a serious issue, and I've actually written an article about the lawsuit for feetcrossing.com, and I looked into it a little bit, but it kind of blows me away that they show this helmet on the first broadcast that has a shock-absorbing face mask, and it was made of much lighter material, and it was like a prototype that it was cost $1,000 a piece, and they showed that only because they had only a few players on each team were wearing it for that game. And I'm thinking, why don't they put this on every player right now? You know, you got to do something, because
I mean, the NFL could do it, and it'd be a drop in the bucket. And I know a couple of the guys that wear them, and they swear by them. You know, they said it's a different feel because your head's literally, you know, sucked in there. But you know, and, I mean, it's, you know, a few years ago, if you remember, there were several players, Merton Hanks and some other guys, that wore the topper. There was like a foam topper that they put on top of their helmet. And everybody made fun of it so much, including commentators, that they stopped wearing them. Well, you know what? It protected their skull. And again, there's a point where you got to stop worrying about what's cool, because you know what's not cool? Not being able to talk to your kids when you're 60. That's not cool. And that's, you know, it's we're finally getting to that point, you know, in sports generally, but we still have a long way to go.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting situation. You know, it's obviously with the science now being so advanced and you know, people more safety conscious, I think, now than ever. You know, every bit of technology, you know, even right down to automobiles, like you were talking about earlier, they're trying to develop technology to prevent injuries, you know, for everything that's dangerous. So it's guys like you that people don't realize go out there and make that happen, force companies and people to raise their eyebrows and say, this is a problem.
Brown lawyers get a bad rap, and everybody likes to make fun of them until they need one. And, you know, I've worked for the largest personal injury firm in the nation, and realized that there's more to it than, you know, taking every case. And you know, we take kind of high-end cases. And brain injury cases, the bad news, they're really sad, because you're dealing with somebody that had their life completely torn apart. They're more dependent on others. If not completely dependent on others, then it's, you know, it's these cases are just about all 7 6 cases, and they call it traumatic brain injury for a reason.
Right.
You know, traumatic in many, many, many ways.
Yeah, I know the lawyers don't get a good reputation, no matter whether you're, you know, a bona fide good lawyer or one of these guys that literally chases ambulances. But actually, I was just out in Vegas for a while, and almost every commercial on TV is a lawyer, and most of them are doing the bankruptcy situations and foreclosures because the housing market's so bad out there. So there are a lot of lawyers trying to help people, you know. The thing that blows me away is all these pharmaceutical commercials. You know, they put out a pharmaceutical now, and they actually tell you it causes death in some cases. You know, this is a pill for you, but it causes death. It's crazy. Anyway, I think we lost him. You didn't want to talk about that subject. I'd like to get a formal close on him, so we'll be going to call back. Maybe he just dropped.
Hey guys, I'm hitting a really bad area.
Oh, sorry. We're used to technical difficulties on this show.
Yeah, it's let me get out of here. But I appreciate you guys having me, and I'll come back anytime.
Sure.
Awesome.
Anybody want to give a shout out to or thank before you go?
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody wanting to know more, we have a sports agency that's MyBTSA, MYBTSA, and our law firm is located at knowthelawyer.com. So if you want to learn more about us, you can check us out there. And surely if you ever need a, you're in the Southeast and you ever need a lawyer, give us a call. We have about 4 different licenses that we handle, 4 different states.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, and best of luck in the future with all your cases.
Thanks, guys. Y'all keep on fighting.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. So that does it. That's 3 guests we had on tonight, Tony. But the third one didn't show up, actually, so that's only 2.
That's okay. I think we did a good job.
We had his answering machine, so technically we had him on. But anyway, actually, that reminds me. Maybe we should try him now. See if he's around. Need to miss at least, you know, a few words with him if we can get it. Tom Yankello. No, I think we're going to wrap it up.
Hello?
Tom.
Hey, Rich.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Are you available right now? Can we talk?
I'm actually driving. Let me pull over on the side of the road here. Yeah, I'm ready, though.
All right. We don't want to cause any accidents.
I was looking for your call around 9:15, but I don't know. I missed the call, I guess, from you around 9:00.
Oh yeah, so we had a guest on at 9:15. We're trying to get you ready.
Okay. For
that.
So you finished up with Roy. Was it good?
Yeah, Roy was great. He took us through the whole gamut, and from day one, literally, to his upcoming fight.
Yeah, it's good.
So, great interview.
I was able to give Roy a scouting, on his upcoming opponent, Max Alexander. I've covered him before, and I know Max because he fights often in the Philadelphia area. So I've seen him live a couple times, and I've seen him obviously on TV on The Contender.
Uh huh.
So okay. the way I described it, I said Max is a very methodical guy. He likes to keep the pace slow. Not a big puncher and not a high output of punches. I said he's almost like a version right now of Bernard Hopkins. Obviously not in the same class as Bernard, but that similar style. Very slow type methodical fighter, likes to control the pace and keep you know, the two-way action to a minimum.
Right.
Now, Tom, you obviously train Wood. Do you train any other guys that are showing a lot of promise down there at your gym?
Oh, yeah, I got a lot of good guys coming up, definitely. I mean, I have Monty Mezzaclay right now. You know, he's, 31-3, I think. He just won the other night. And then I have a kid, Andre Tater, who's a cruiserweight also. He's 20-1. And then I have a super middleweight, 4-0. And then I have a welterweight prospect, Jesse Lubash, who's 15-0 right now.
I've heard the name.
What's that?
I've heard that name.
Right, and then Morgan Fitch is the super middle. He's 4-0. But those kids there, and then I have a couple amateur kids coming out. We're going to be pretty good in the future here, but they're a ways off. But a couple more years, I'd probably turn them pro. Pretty good prospects.
And how did you first meet Roy and get involved with training him?
Well, he's been involved with some promotions up here, and he has been up here for the last 3 or 4 years promoting left, you know, some of the shows. He's probably done about 2 or 3 shows a year up here in the last since 2009, anyways, last couple of years. And we met each other a couple times through that. And then they had trained up here in Cal, PA, which is about an hour from my gym. He was training up there also. So I had taken some of my guys up there to spar, and we met up there before. But just recently, over the last, over the summer, we had a radio interview for one of the shows in August. He had promoted the show in August, and then he came and did a radio interview in my gym. And I was also on the show. And then you know, we just started talking, and I told him, well, why don't you come up a couple weeks and work with me and see how you like it and see how we mesh. And he says, you know what? He says, you know, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna come up a couple weeks, and I'm gonna work with you and see how we mesh. And that was it. Basically just took me up on my offer, and then we started working together. The first week of September, he came out right before Labor Day, and we worked up for about 2 weeks, and we had a lot of fun, and we hit it off real well, and he went home, and then he came back for another 2 weeks, and then he went home, and we came back for he's been with me last four weeks, so we had a good rapport. Good chemistry, hit it off real well, and we've just been going to work on things. You know, I've been trying to get to use a lot of the things that he was doing early on in his career, but he kind of left it alone because he was so good and so dominant that he didn't have to use it. You know, and then also just working on some things that he has and never really used, but he just needs to add to his game as he. As he gets a little older, he's going to have to be a little bit more technical because you know, just can't win on your God-given talent forever, you know.
Yeah.
And he's such a natural talent that's something that, you know, has been a transition for him that he has never had to really do. You know, he's never had to work on technical stuff and be a real, you know, schooled guy because he's got to be the most talented boxer to ever lace up gloves. When you just talk about raw talent in the talent department, I mean, I don't think there's ever been a guy that's been, you know, had more talent than Roy Jones. I mean, we could name on one hand maybe a few guys that come close, but I mean, as far as raw talent, I mean, I don't know. I've watched old films. I've watched a lot of guys. I mean, there's been guys that maybe have been technically better and been better fighters, maybe. I mean, his prime, he's arguably one of the greatest ever, you know. And I'm sure there's some people who think he was the greatest ever. But a lot of that, like I said, it was just because he's so talented. And I just think the fights that he's lost, you know, because of technical skills and things that he needed to work on that, you know, he really didn't in his prime. He never had to, so he never had to develop it. And he never, and he let it go of a lot of things that he was, even as an Olympian. I watched some of the things, how he was using his jab a lot better. And when he got in the pros there, later on, when he was in a light heavy and he was dominating, he didn't have to do anything but just use his speed any which way he wanted to. So just trying to get him to tighten up a little bit defensively and work on technical things and just become a better fighter. The talent is still there. I mean, if he's dropped off a little bit, I mean, I've never witnessed anybody with the hand speed that he still has. I mean, I have guys that are pretty fast, but he's still a little faster.
Right.
Talking about Roy and his, you know, talent and his style, I train some young fighters now, and even when I was training guys, you know, even when I was still kind of fighting myself and I was kind of mentoring younger fighters, helping them out and everything, the one thing I would do was, you know, a lot of guys would like to imitate their heroes. I had a guy that was a teammate of mine at Lock Haven. He was such a big Roy Jones fan that when he would walk to the ring, he would have a Roy Jones T-shirt on. I mean, he was a big fan. But at the same time, it's like, you know, his name is Shannon. I'm like, Shannon, you cannot try to imitate Roy in the ring. You don't have his punching power. You got quick hands, yes, but you got quick hands more of a defense-type fighter, you know, jab and keep a guy off you type fighter, peck from the outside. You don't have, you know, that the quick hands that Roy Jones kind of utilizes with the leap-in hooks and all that. I said, you'll never be able to do it. Wouldn't listen, you know, he wanted to fight like Roy Jones did, and it ended up, you know, costing him a shot at the national title because he, you know, did dumb things and got his clock cleaned. When I train guys now, and obviously, you know, guys like to watch fights, especially young kids, and I'll tell them, you know, it's great to have guys that you admire, but if you're not them, don't try to be them. Like in the 70s, you had guys that wanted to imitate Ali. If you ain't Ali, don't try to be Ali. Now I got a friend of mine that, you know, he's a big Floyd Mayweather fan. And he was fighting on ESPN about a year ago, and he was winning the fight, and he started doing, you know, some Floyd Mayweather and all that. I'm like, you don't got, you're good, you're not that good. He ended up getting clocked, and he ended up losing that fight. But that was a good thing that made him smarter, realizing, you know what, maybe if I'm stepping out and stepping to the side, maybe I should keep my hands up when I do it. You know, but guys back in the 90s, I know, hey, who wouldn't want to be like Roy Jones? I mean, the guy's phenomenal. But I couldn't fight like him. I'm a 5'8", 175-pound guy that's thickly built and, you know, not the fastest guy in the world. If I tried to fight with my hands at my sides, leaping in and throwing hooks, I'd get my clock cleaned.
Right. Absolutely.
Thing is, though, I even told Roy, a lot of boxers today coming up try to adapt his style, and a lot of them do well, but only if they at least keep one hand up, you know? Not a lot of people can get away with keeping both down like Roy used to do, and probably you know now that Roy can't get away with it now. But the one hand up and the left hand low with the up jab, everybody's doing that in some gyms. And they just develop that, and they get good at it, and they get good at moving their head so they don't get hit. And that sort of opens up different angles for them to throw punches, too. So it just makes them a better fighter. But, you know, it's interesting to see how some orthodox boxers that always keep two hands up, you know, whenever they're not punching, don't do so well against those guys. They have something they never seen.
Exactly.
But how tough was it to break Roy of those type of habits with, you know, leaving the hands down and being flashy?
Well, I'll tell you what. He came with an open mind, everything that I was, you know, wanting to work with him on. And he adjusted well. And some of the things are just so ingrained in him and natural, that some of the things are going to still be there. And some of the things I didn't try to take it away from him, because he still has, you know, he comes from crazy angles at times, and things I didn't want to take away from him because it just makes him who he is, and I didn't want to do that. But I wanted to try to get him to change up a little bit, so because the guys that he's fighting are not looking at that, and they're not being able to predict when he's going to do it. And just for him to change it up a little bit and still be doing some of the things that he does, but, you know, he can't be in that posture at all times and be predictable when he's going to do it. And, you know, just try to add some things and tighten him up without taking away what he does great. And that's been, you know, that's not sometimes very, it's not easy to do, you know, because you're trying to make things better and make things more technical. At the same time, you don't want to restrict him and stop him from doing what made him great, but just add to it and clean it up a little bit, make it a little bit more technical. And we've been able to do that. I mean, I think people are going to be surprised. I think he definitely, and I mean, and we're not done doing it. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm looking for this to be a future thing. I mean, this is not just a one fight where I think he's gonna pass flying colors at this fight. We're gonna go on from here. We're still planning to win the Cruiserweight Championship. So I mean, I think every fight he will get a little bit more better technically, and you'll still see the flair of Roy Jones, but you'll just it'll be a little bit different, a little bit sneakier, a little less unpredictable. You'll see it in spots, but you just won't see it at all time. You know, you just won't see that all the time and know when it's coming or think you know when it's coming. Before, people didn't, they knew it was coming and they still couldn't stop it. Now, they know when they know it's coming, they kind of can stop it now. So as long as he's not so predictable, he can still do some of the lead hooks and the right hand. He can still do those kind of things, but he's got to set it up a little bit better, be a little bit more technical in setting it up, using his jab a little bit more. And, you know, I think it's going to make a huge difference, where he's still going to be able to do some of the things he's doing, but it's just going to be a lot less predictable. And I think every fight he'll improve. You know, each and every fight that we work together as we go on down the ladder here towards a Cruiserweight title, I think you'll see it more and more, where he's able to blend what he's done in the past into another style where he's a lot more technical. And I'm just excited about it, because I've definitely seen gains in him. We've got about 8 weeks to work together. We had 2 weeks, and then we weren't together for a couple weeks, then we came back for another two, and then he was off for two, and then he's come back the last four weeks. So we've had about 8 weeks together, and I've definitely seen some good gains in the last 8 weeks, and he's blended things without – I've been able to blend things without taking his strengths away.
What's it like when he comes in the gym? Does the other boxers there perk up? Does he interact well with the people there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he lights up the gym. I mean, he's one of those charismatic guys that, I mean, he carries, you know, he's got that charisma, and he's got that aura about him when he walks into the gym. Yeah, he definitely lights up the whole gym. And I've had people come from all over, just for the word that Roy Jones in the gym, and to train, and to, maybe I've got guys come to just spar with them. Out of the blue, we'll have a gym full of people, and I didn't even know these people were coming. I mean, they just were here that he's training at a certain time, and the gym will light up. I mean, it's just a lot of people. I mean, I'd say about 3 or 4 weeks ago, maybe two or three weeks ago, we had probably about 50, 60 people just came in the gym. They were from all over. I had them from Harrisburg, Delaware, Philadelphia, York, PA. We had a gym full of guys, and I have a lot of my other friends. They were all sparring. We just had a great sparring session. It was a Saturday, and some of the people I knew were coming, and they told their friends, and their friends told their friends, and before you knew it, I had about 50, 60 people in the gym. And I have a balcony in my gym, and I had to get a lot of people off of the gym floor to put them up in the balcony, and they were watching. And I mean,
turned into an exhibition.
What's that?
Turned into an exhibition, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it really was. It really was, and you know, it's just, yeah, it definitely has brought a lot of life to my gym, and.
he still has that aura about him that just draws people. And he's a lot of fun in the gym, man. And he's one of the greats of all time. I mean, and we had this cruiserweight title to him. He'll be a 9-time world champion in 5 different divisions. So that's our goal. And I tell you, he's not a prima donna by any means. I was very shocked on how willing he is to work hard, and he really wants to make this comeback. I mean, he doesn't want to end his career on the note that he's that's happened in the last couple of fights here. But he's determined not to let that be the end of his career like that. I mean, he's very into his legacy, and he's reborn. I mean, as far as I can see, as far as work ethic and really willing to learn, and he is learning. He is learning, definitely learning, and he's working on the things that I want him to work on. And I tell you, I just think he's got the potential to be a cruiserweight world title holder again, and really attract some big fights at cruiserweight because of his name. And I just don't think he's going to end the way people think he's going to end. I think he's going to make a very I just see a lot of life in him right now. And of course, I've never been dealing with him to know the way he was before, but from what I heard from the people that have been around him, they say they haven't seen him like this in years. So,
there you go. Your work is
really excited about.
Well, it's not done, but you've done well yourself. But as a boxing expert, obviously, you sound like you really know the game. Speaking of guys that light up a gym, I actually was fortunate enough when I was out in Vegas recently to go to an open workout session that Floyd Mayweather had before fighting out when he's there. Talk about attracting attention, man. It was intense. I'd never seen so many cameras in one room.
He's definitely an attention magnet, that's for sure.
But obviously the big fight that everybody in boxing is kind of calling for now is Mayweather versus Pacquiao. What do you think about that whole saga and who's going to win if they do fight?
I just hope it will happen, but I think that's the problem. I don't know if it'll happen. I think until Mayweather's seen how vulnerable Pacquiao was against Marquez and realized that he wasn't, I think he had caught the imagination of so many people of beating the guys that he beat. And I mean, not taking anything away from Pacquiao, but he beat a very dehydrated, dried-up Oscar De La Hoya. He beat a washed-up Ricky Hatton. I believe he beat Cotto, who was down in weight. He had to catch weight at 145, which was very hard for Cotto to make. And Cotto had just come off that loss against Margarito, which I think took a lot out of him. With the controversy there, with the hands, the plaster in the hands, and I definitely believe that Margarito did that against him. And then you had Joshua Quaddy, and then Margarito, who was kind of. So I mean, I think there's been a lot of. I think Pacquiao is perceived to be this monster, but I think that Marquez showed you that he's not the monster that everybody was perceiving him to be. If you counterpunch and you box, and I think that these guys that he beat were all guys that just came right at you, like Ricky Hatton, Margarito, De La Hoya. You get a guy that's a good counterpuncher, which Mayweather is. I mean, I would have to pick Mayweather in that fight if that fight happened.
Yeah,
I just think that.
That's him. I'm leaning towards him now, too. I just mentioned that earlier in the show. And it's not just because of Pacquiao's last show. It's also because I think Floyd developed himself into some different habits that are good for him. Like, he doesn't do the shoulder roll as much anymore.
Right. I mean, I just think that Mark Kennedy is a good counterpuncher, and he gave Pacquiao a lot of problems. Mayweather is a greater counterpuncher than Marquez is. He uses his shoulder roll better. He has a better jab, and he's quicker. So, I mean, from what I've seen with Marquez, I see Mayweather fighting the same fight, but I see Mayweather just being able to be a lot better and much more effective
than Marquez was. So, I mean, I have to take Floyd in that fight by decision. Probably be decision because just for the simple fact that Floyd he doesn't want to take risks. And I don't know if he would be able to stop Pacquiao because he doesn't want to get into that risk factor where he could get caught with a shot. But Pacquiao moves his feet, which I like, which would give Mayweather some trouble, and he does put pressure on you, which Mayweather has problems with guys sometimes that put a lot of pressure on him. But I still have to go with Mayweather. I think Mayweather now wants to fight because he's seen what Marquez would do. Now I think Bob Arum is on the other side of the play. I think he believes that Pacquiao can't beat Mayweather now. So now he says, I think
the show is running out of time here. So
yes. Okay.
Does anybody want to give a shout out to or say hello to? Now's the time.
Well, I tell you what, I just look forward to everybody showing up for the fight next week in Atlanta, and hope everybody comes down to see. I think it should be a very entertaining fight. I think you'll see Roy, turn into a different fighter. I think he's not the same guy you've seen in the last two or three fights for sure.
Awesome.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you, Rich.
We'll keep in touch and we'll keep promoting everything you guys are doing.
I appreciate it. Have a good night, man. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, well, I didn't hear the show, do the 5-second countdown, but they did the 10-second countdown. I think we're already gone. So we're signing off.